So I want to think a little bit about the beginning of the parsha, the connection to the end of the parsha, and then we'll start looking what we have in front of us. Noach is an interesting character, and there are certain, shall we say, he's a tzaddik, let's be honest. He's the only tzaddik in the entire Chumash, unless you want to include Yosef, but Yosef is not called a tzaddik in the Chumash. He's called a tzaddik in the Navi. He's called a tzaddik, which itself is interesting, because there's all other kinds of people that we would like to believe are very good people, and none of them are called tzaddikim, but Noach is called a tzaddik. One thing that, right away you got to start, I don't mean to pick on you, and I don't mean to pick on Rashi, I don't mean to pick on anyone else, but it doesn't say tzaddik vidorotov.
No.
Who says it? Rashi is a little coy, because it's not what it says in the source that he takes it from the Gemara. Hold it, I'll explain. The pasuk actually says, Ela told Noach, Noach ish tzaddik, tamim haya bidorotav. He was perfect in his generation. It doesn't say tzaddik bidorotav. And over here is where the whole drasha comes out. That's where Rashi says, different opinions. It's actually the verse later on, which is the one that we should be referring to, but that's not the one that, for whatever reason, they make the drasha on. In Perek Zayin Pasuk Aleph, it says, Vayomer Hashem Noach, Boata, V'chol Beitcha El HaTeva, Ki Otcha Re'iti Tzadik Lefanai B'dor Hazeh. So that, I think, is a little better than Noach Ish Tzadik, Tamim Haya B'dor Otav. B'dor Otav, he was a tzadik. No, B'dor Otav, he was Tamim. So if you put that together with this, then I think it comes a little bit clearer. But why are we picking on Noach? I mean, he's a tzaddik. Why are we picking on him? So I'll tell you exactly what I think the problem is, and that's going to help lead us towards the end of the parsha. When we think about Noah being a tzaddik, so the first thing I would ask is, so how exactly does his tzidkut manifest itself? You know, there was a book which a number of people my age have said the same thing. You know, I'm quite old. I'm not as old as some of the people here who perhaps remember the last time the Cubs won the World Series. So, yes. So, the book which, as I said, a number of people my age have told me that this made a profound difference in life, and that was the book about Rabbi Levine, a tzaddik in our time. And if you read the book from cover to cover, and I say, so what made him into a tzaddik? Well, read every single page of the book, and you see why or how his tzidkut was manifest. I mean, it's full of great stories. There's one great story that somebody sees him from afar, and they start trying to run away from him because he's not wearing a yarmulke, and he calls him, he catches him, looks, and he says, why are we running away? He goes, because they never yarmulke on. So Rabbi said, but I'm very short. I can only see your heart. Your heart looked very nice. I couldn't see what's on top of your head. Now the truth is that's something which is very, very special. It's disarming somebody and calming someone down and saying, listen, Tabi said then. So you have a whole book full of righteous things. So what exactly is the righteous thing which Noach did? And let's pause there for a second, because my suspicion is that Noach didn't do anything righteous. I apologize for saying that. If he didn't do anything righteous, then why is he a tzaddik?
They
didn't do anything bad. He didn't do anything bad. Matter of fact, I'm even willing to throw out a theory that, of course, you can disprove me later, and that is that maybe to be a tzaddik really means to withstand temptation. Maybe the concept of tzidkut means to withstand temptation more so than the way it would be used in our, post-Baal Shem Tov generation, where we have all kinds of tzaddikim all over the place. And by the way, then Yosef becomes the perfect tzaddik as well, that Yosef is a tzaddik specifically because he withstands temptation. It's this withstanding temptation. I can say tzaddik is also, it's a judicial term. Somebody who's found righteous in judgment, so vitztiko et tzaddik, the person is righteous in judgment. It doesn't mean the person is saintly. Yeah, Abba.
Yeah, I've had a temptation to interpret in terms of the ritual.
And you've withstood the temptation?
So not this, not the tzaddik.
Okay.
Tzaddik comes the word tzaddik, and chassid comes the word chesed. And we usually shift it totally. But that means he was involved in tzaddik. which meant in a country, in a community or a world that was totally immoral or not just, he was at least just.
Right. Okay. So that, so as I said, that's exactly the issue. That it sounds much more of a judicial term than it sounds like we would use it in our post Baal Shem Tov or in today's world where anybody could be a tzaddik. You just have to take out an ad in the Yellow Pages. So. Okay. So let's stop for a moment. Correct. Let's stop for a moment with Noach. We're not told of anything that Noah did. We're not told of any righteous thing that he did. Only thing that we're told is that it's a really bad generation and he doesn't do what they do, apparently, and that's what makes him righteous. But here's what really bothers me. As I said, this is going to lead us more towards the second half. At the very end of the whole episode, Noah does the only religious gesture he does in the entire thing, and that is he builds a Mizbeach. Without that Mizbeach, I don't know what I would say about Noah, because, again, there's nothing. So he builds a Mizbeach, and it generates a Reach Nichoach Lashem. Of course, then he plants his vineyard, and we know about his post-traumatic stress, and he went through a Holocaust, and he was the only survivor, and maybe he felt some guilt because he didn't do anything. But at the end, God makes a covenant with him. There is a Brit over there, and that's what bothers me. Again, this is not in front of us right here, but that's what bothers me. The Brit is, at most, a non-belligerency pact. Non-belligerence. I will not do terrible things to you. It's not the kind of Brit that we're going to have later on with Avraham. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bless your children. I'm going to give you this land and I will be there for you and so on. All that it is, I'm not going to wipe you out again. That's what's disappointing. At the end of the day, what are we left with? Okay, you behave and I'll behave. That's what we have over here. It doesn't sound like a covenant among friends. Do you understand what I'm saying? It sounds like a peace treaty between two enemies. And I don't want to go that far to say enemies, but I'm just pointing out that the second that Avraham comes on the scene, we have a love story. And it's a love story between Avraham and God, between God and Avraham. And the words that are said, the covenants which are drawn, the promises that are made, it's a love story. Between Noah and God, there's no love story. All that it is, okay, I'm not going to wipe you out. So that's really what I wanted to say as far as an introduction goes. We have in the Parsha essentially two generations, in order to get, which are, of course, conveniently 10 generations apart, but we have two generations. And the first generation, we only get the real sense of it when we read the end of last week's Parsha. Anybody who had the fortune or misfortune to go through Jewish schools, a lot of that gets cleansed out, and all that they have is they stole less than a Shefa Pruta, and they get the Rishami in this. I think it was a wonderful lesson for kindergarten teachers throughout the years. Oh, you took something, that's how the flood came, watch out. But if we look at the end of last week's Parsha, it gives us a little bit more perspective, and the Ibn Ezra in the beginning of this week's parsha goes back and points there, and he says, no, these people were, the powerful men were grabbing, taking whatever women they can. I mean, maybe it sounded romantic to you. I mean, who am I to... Yeah, I was going to say, who am I to understand such things when it says, Adam, and Elohim I absolutely understand as the sons of the powerful, as Tarkum Unkelus, as the Rav Ravei, those who have power. Elohim, even when it refers to God, is the Almighty, again referring to power. Vayirubnei Elohim et benot Adam, ki tovotena, which, you know, is a tovot, brings us all the way back to the Garden of Eden, things are good, ki tov, and so on. They see they're good. And they took any women, whoever they chose. By the way, if it only says Vechul Lehem Nashim, they got married, that would be okay. When it says Vechul Lehem Nashim Mikol Asher Bacharu, whoever they chose, there you have an indication of violence, and there you have an indication that there was not necessarily a courtship and dating or 12 roses that were given. I'm not revealing any secrets here. What we have over here instead is an act of violence. So what makes Noach great? What makes Noach great is that he didn't rape anybody based on this definition. There are many tzaddikim in the room today. Based on any other definition, I don't know. But based on this definition, the lack of doing evil. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. So here's one generation where there are no boundaries. The powerful take. It's pretty much like today. The people take whatever they want. Might makes right. And that leads us into, and again, the one who's different is Noah. And that leads us into where we begin our story today. And that's in the first source, Perek Yud Aleph. And that, of course, is the story of the tower. Now, as much as perhaps we would be tempted to look at the story of the tower independently of anything that happened before, I think perhaps we would be wise to consider it a response to what happened before. Because over here we have many different elements. Over here, let's start from the beginning. So what do we hear right away? People speak one language. People are unified. So instead of society breaking down and being one of violence, what do we have instead? We have one of unity, which, by the way, sounds very nice. And that already gives us a hint that they moved away from the east, they moved away from where they had been before. And they find a valley in the land of Shinar. In the past, we've discussed why specifically this valley, not today. And they settled there. And again, a word of friendship. Vayomru ish el re'ehu. Man said to his neighbor. Now that is a nice verse, because there's a sense of neighborliness, there's a sense of unity. Vayomru ish el re'ehu. Hava nilbana levenim v'nisrfa l'sreifa v'tehilem alevena la'avin v'chemer hoya lehem l'chomer. Now the truth is the rest of the verse is a little boring, and we're a little actually surprised that it just went so much into detail. It's giving us building plans. Well, let's start building, and let's start making, and let's start getting bricks, and let's build, and then leading to the next verse, which, by the way, I would have put before, first the plan, first the larger plan, and then the details how to do it. Vayomru hava nivna lanu ir umigdal v'rosho b'shamayim v'naseh lanu shem. Let's go build this tower, and the head will lead all the way up to the sky, and we will make for ourselves v'naseh lanu, how would you translate shame? Okay, so for lack of any better interpretation for right now, let's say, let's make a name for ourselves. Lest we be divided upon all of the land. Now that itself is very interesting, because how often do you have someone do something in Tanakh? And by the way, at this point we have no idea why it's right or why it's wrong, but they say, well, if we don't do this, this is what's going to happen. And of course, what does God do? God then divides them all over the place. So God chooses what they're afraid of to be the very punishment. So it's at this point we now know that we have no idea what's going on. That's exactly what I wanted to point to over here, is that there's something very enigmatic about this. But even though parts of it are enigmatic, what do we know? What do we understand? We understand that there is this opposite sense. Now, if you want, again, we'll go back to our children of the 40s or 50s, and you want to talk about communism or socialism, or, you know, what would you have said if I would have translated in the third verse, Vayomru ish el re'ehu, each person said to his comrade, right? Would that have changed the verse completely? Let's build something together, it's all for one, we're building something together. And that's really the sense that we get over here. And let's keep that in mind. So they're afraid of being divided, and let's build something like this. And God doesn't seem to like it. Vayomer Hashem, him am echad v'safa achad l'kulam, and as per the Alshich, this is how we'll read it, v'zehi chilam lasot, which means they're unified, they speak one language, which are good things, and this is what they're doing, which means there seems to be some kind of understanding that unity could be used in a different way. Unity could have been used in, we'll leave it for right now, and what they could have done. God said, I will not let them do which they've plotted to do. God is going to come down and confuse their language. That they're going to have confusion, and man will not understand his comrade. And God divides them in the whole land. And then they stop building the city. Alkein Karashma Bavel, and therefore became called Bavel, Kisham Balal Hashem Svat Kol Aretz, for their God confused all of the language of the land. And Misham Hifitzam Hashem Apnei Kol Aretz, and there God divided them. So what exactly did they do wrong? So I know as well as you do, because I've received the same indoctrination, and that is that they were plotting to go up to heaven, and they were plotting to wage war against God. And do you notice the one thing which is missing in the entire narrative till God gets involved in it? God. Everything is here except for God. Because if they're going to fight against God, God isn't here. God is not acknowledged. They're building a big tower. They're unified. They're together. But the one thing which is missing in all this is any mentioning of God. And God seems to be quite displeased with this, and that's when they get all divided. Rashbam, who also was indoctrinated as a child, went to a good yeshiva, sat on Rashi's knee. Hava nivnan lanu ir, lefi hapshat. You notice what he's saying? Don't tell me the stories. Lefi hapshat, machatu dor haflaga, or hapilaga. What was their sin? Imi b'sha'om uvarosho b'shamayim hoktiv, arim delot v'zor b'shamayim. Elefi shet sivam ha-kadosh baruch hu, peru urevu umelu ta'aretz. God gave them a command to disperse. V'him bachru lahem makom l'shevet sham v'rupen nafotz. V'fitzam mishum gzerato. And therefore, God spread them. I mean, this is exactly the point. So they were defying one of the rules which was handed down to them, and that rule was to spread out. The pasuk which he's referring to apparently is in source 3, by Vayivarech Elokim et Noach et Banav, Vayomer lahem peru umelu ta'aretz. The Netziv points out in source number 4, Vayomer lahem peru, Ein ze ela bracha. He disagrees. No, this was not a command. This was a bracha. How does he know it's a bracha? Vayivarech Elokim. God blessed them and said, this is what you should do. Ditzivoy apuruvu, nemar b'lesof, atem puruvu, ki deperish Rashi. He's not so convinced that this is necessarily a mitzvah, a tzivoy, as much as it is a blessing. On the other hand, in source number 5, back in Perek Aleph, where God is going to create man, Pasukov Zayin, Vayavar Elokim et Adam Bitzalmo, and Chule, Pasukov Ched, Vayavar Chatam Elokim, Vayomer lahem peru, urevu, umelu ta'aretz, vikivshuha. So as far as the Bechor Shur is concerned, in source 6, and he comes from the same school as the Rashbam, more or less, he writes, Pen nafutz al pnei kol ha'aretz v'kshu levatel ma shagazar HaKadosh Baruch Hu umalu et ha'aretz v'kavshuha. So it's interesting that they both have the same idea. The Rashbam is focusing on a post-flood idea of what they should be doing, while the Bechor Shur is going back to the very creation of man. There was this, and it's interesting, because I thought we would put it in the Garden of Eden. Even if in the Garden of Eden, there seems to be some kind of command to spread out all over, and they're trying to frustrate the divine will of man spreading out throughout the entire planet, and therefore these commentaries see this as being a punishment. The Ramban actually has a nice word for them, Vanchef Pelaga al Divrei Rabbeinu Mordim Biboram. The rabbinic approach to this is the rebel against God, and that's all the Midrashim that you know, they're climbing to heaven, wage war against God. So the Ramban says, this is, by the way, the middle of the Ramban, I just conveniently cut where I wanted to. He says that the rabbinic approach is wage war against God. Now, you like the next two words? The Rodfei Hapshat. It's hard to know if he's saying this, that he likes it or he doesn't like it. The Rodfei Hapshat. How would you translate that? Those who pursue truth. Those who pursue a more straightforward interpretation of the text. And literal, I'm afraid of. Those who prefer a more straightforward interpretation, and he says, look in the Ben Ezra, look in the Radak, so you know that there are others as well. Omrim, shlo yadatam elisha yu yachad michubram ki yagida katuv pen nefot. They want to be together. They didn't want to spread about. And as far as I said, they're concerned, that's the approach. The Ramban then goes into his Kabbalistic interpretations. And we're going to skip it. That's what happens when I get stuck in traffic. But you can read the Ramban, not understand it, and then you can read the Rabbeinu Bechaye in source number 8, and then have a chance to understand it. But what they are doing is they're going back to the more rabbinic understanding, and that is there's some kind of war against God being waged. And I'll say it again. The background for saying this, or the textual reason to say this, is not anything the text says. It's what the text is missing. It's that it doesn't say anything about God. That's why they see the war against God. How can you not bring God? It's the Bible. How can you not bring God into this? This is God's book. What's the matter with you? So, let's go all the way to, before I tell you where we're going, let me first talk a little bit. I haven't talked enough today. There's two ways of doing interpretation right now. We'll skip to two. One is reading something in context and trying to understand it in context. We just now did that. There's not that much there. More is missing than what is there. The other thing that we can do is look for a parallel, and then based on the parallel, try to see if it gives us any kind of insight. And over here, there is a parallel. The only thing which is surprising is that as far as I could tell, and I'm not saying that this is an absolute conclusion, but as far as I can tell, I didn't find anybody before the 20th century who really focused on this. And since the 20th century, both in out of the yeshiva, more out of the yeshiva, and in the yeshiva, you find people who start to make this association. Again, as far as I can tell, the first one to do it was Kasuto, but let's take a look. On page 3, in source 11, in page 3, in source number 11, Vayetze Yaakov mi Beersheva, Vayelech Harana. By the way, what's interesting about this, Yaakov is actually on the move. Here are people who don't want to be on the move. I know at first, when I say things like this, you're going to say, okay, you're pushing it a little bit. I'm not pushing anything. Yaakov is moving. They don't want to move. By the way, did Yaakov really want to move? Did Yaakov really want to spread out? He has no choice. But continue. How would you prefer to translate that? He had a vision or he had a dream? So we'll say a dream, but you all know it's really a vision. He sees a... Now all of you are going to tell me it means a ladder. I just will point out the word sulam is never used again in Tanakh as far as I know. Sorry. So anytime... What's the word for that when it's only used once? Apox legemenon. No, I can't spell it either. Legemenon. It's a fancy word to use whenever a word appears only once. As far as I know, the sulam occurs only once. Of course, we decide the sulam is a ladder, and everyone has ladders, so therefore the sulam means a ladder, but I hope you realize there is something a little circular, which actually means you have no idea what Yaakov saw in his dream. I'm sorry for saying that. You have no idea what he sees. What's the answer? What does he see? There's only one way to answer the question. What did Yaakov actually see? Sulam. That's all you can say. That's all you can say. But what do you know about the sulam? Let's continue reading. V'hinei sulam mutzav arza v'rosho magia hashamayma. So now, okay, now why did I just now go here? Because there was something here parallel to the Migdal, and that was the rosho v'hashamayim. That was something going on. Now, you do realize that I could call this sulam a building. You do realize and call that building a sulam. That's just because I can do anything that I want. There is a whole topic within antiquity about these kinds of buildings that were big. And do you know anything about these? Or no, in terms of archaeology? Wonderful. But Zugatz. Okay, there we go. He's got everything today. And most days. And the question is, what's the relationship? So Yaakov sees a sulam mutzav arza v'roshu magia hashamayma. And right away, what I want to do now is to ask the question, so what is the significance of this parallel between what happened over there versus what happens over here, and therefore what will it teach us? How is it instructed? So right away there's a difference. What's the difference? So when they built it, why did they build it? Is there a stated use for building it? When they built it, is there a stated use? It's actually, it never says anything about climbing up the building. There are those who've claimed, again, we can call them Rodfei Hapshat, we skip some of them, who claim that it's like a lighthouse. That if they start to spread too far around, you always have the tower to tell you how to come back home. It was never built to climb up. This is actually, again, I'm going to say this. We all learned as kids, they were going to climb up and take their sticks and go to war against God. It just doesn't say that. Now, when I go back and read the pshat there and read the pshat over here, what does it say over here? What does Yaakov see? Yaakov does see the ability of climbing up and coming down, which I can just as easily say is what Yaakov dreams of, is some type of a religious experience. The ability of going up towards heaven, Malchei Elokim, is quite significant, but that's not enough. Yet Yaakov, it goes a little bit further. In Pasuk Yud Gimel, it says, "Vihine Hashem nitzav alav," and God is standing on top of it. And by the way, the it can either be of the sulam or it could be in front of Yaakov, but God is right there. By the way, do you notice that God makes an appearance in both stories? There, God comes down, takes a look what's going on, which, by the way, is said by Rashi and others for judicial purposes, teaches you, even God is all-knowing, that when you judge, you come down and take a look what the real situation is. But over here, we have God appearing. Now listen to what God says. And now you'll decide if there really is any connection. Although you don't have to work so hard, because there already is a connection. What is the connection? The fact that it uses the same phrase of Rosho Bashamayim, about the head of it, or the top of it going up into heavens. But what does God say here? Vayomer. Ani Hashem Elokei Avraham Avicha Elokei Yitzchak Haaretz Asher Ata Shochev Aleha Lecha Nena Ulazarecha. And that's why I gave you the whole introduction today. That's the kind of verse which is completely missing in the narrative between God and Noach, and subsequently Noach's children and grandchildren and great grandchildren, and so on. We don't have a verse like that. VaYazarecha KaAfar Aretz UFaratzta Yama VeKedma VeTzafona VeNegva VeNifrachu B'Chakol. So what did it just now say that you will do? To spread out. So there we had this desire of staying together, and over here we have this desire of this idea of spreading out. Here they all want to stay in one place, and here Yaakov is on the move. So as I said, I'm just trying to point out that it seems to me that to be able to understand the tower properly, we need to understand this vision properly, because this vision may very well be giving us information which we've missed when we read about the tower, which will then let us know. What's Yaakov's response? Right, and God continues, in Tetvav, and says, "V'nei nochi imach, u'shmarticha b'chol asher telech, v'ashivoticha el adama hazot, ki lo zavcha, ad asher asiti et kol asher dibarti lach." Which again, the difference between those who want to stay in one place versus Yaakov, who now is on the move. V'yikatz Yaakov mishnato, v'yomar chen yesh Hashem b'makom hazeh, which is the one thing that is never said in chapter 11. God is here. V'nochi lo yodati, v'yira v'yomar manora ha'makom hazeh. What does Yaakov say? How awesome is this place? Ein zeki im beit Elokim v'zeshar shemayim. This is the house of God, and this is the gates to heaven. V'eshkem Yaakov v'boker, v'yikach et ha'evin asher sami roshotav, v'yasem oto matzeva. Yaakov makes a matzeva. What's a matzeva? A monument. V'yitzok shem anarosha, v'yikra et shem ha'makom ahu beit el. And at the very end, what are we told? Yaakov says, "Va'evin azot asher samti matseva ye beit Elokim." The Yaakov's whole conclusion is that he's going to build a beit Elokim. So let's try a couple of things. One, we're going to skip all the upcoming sources and go straight to 19. Source 19 on page number 4. A pasuk in Yeshayahu, we read this as the Haftarah on fast days. Ki ko amar Hashem l'sarisim asher yishmaru at shabtotai uvacharu v'asher chafatzti machzikim b'viriti v'natati lahem b'veiti uvachomatai yad v'ashem tov mi banim u'banot. Very, very difficult verse. He says to the sarisim, he says to those who can't have children, what does he say to them? I'm going to give you a Yad Vashem, and it's better than Banim Uvanot, which is a little difficult to convince us. But what's a Yad Vashem? Because I think you all know how Yad Vashem is used today. Or I'll ask you even better. What does the word Yad mean in that context? Monument. What's a Shem? Yad Vashem.
Memorial.
It's a memorial. When they say in the beginning, "V'nased lanu Shem," I don't believe they were saying we're going to make a name for ourselves. I believe what they were saying is we're going to make some kind of a memorial, some kind of a monument. And again, I want to go back to Yaakov. Yaakov builds a matzeva, and he says, this matzeva will be a Beit Elokim. And as my father said, if you didn't hear what he said, That must be what Yaakov sees. He sees the Beit Elohim, which means we all think it's a ladder. He sees... I mean, what draws him to this conclusion to build... Again, look at the words in Yaakov's dream once again. I know you're going to tell me he saw a sulam. Again, I'll say we don't know what the sulam is. He may see a building. He may see the Beit HaMikdash reaching all the way up into Shemayim. By the way, what's the continuation of those verses in Yeshayahu? One verse later. Pasuk Vav. Uvnei ha-nechar ha-nilvim al Hashem l'sharato olavat Hashem et Shem Hashem liyot lo lavadim kol shemer shabat michalom achzikim bevriti v'haviotim el harakadshi v'simachtim bevet tfilati olotehem v'zivchehem l'ratzon ha-mizbechi ki beiti beit tfila yikare l'kol ha-amim. So why am I here? The Yad Vashem is the Beit Elohim. Yaakov sees it, it's a Beit Elohim. Yaakov is building a Beit Elohim. He sees it, he knows it, he commits to it, and that's what's going on. But these people, they're building something else. What does God come down and say? They're united. They speak one language. V'zehi chelam lasot, and this is what they're doing? Is being united good? Look at source 20 in Sephaniah. I'm sorry for quoting. These are really Jewish prophets, by the way, Yeshayahu and Sephaniah, those of you who don't know. Look at Sephaniah. Zephaniah. L'chein chakulin u mashem li yom kumi la'ad ki mishpat l'asaf goyim l'kovtsimi malchut l'shpoch aleim za'ami kol charon api ki be'esh k'naiti tochel kol ha'aretz. Ki az ha'foch el amim safa brura l'kro kulam b'shem Hashem l'avdo shechem achad. The day will come, they're all going to speak one language. They're all going to be unified. But for what purpose will they be unified? They'll all be purpose what? To call b'shem Hashem, ula avdo shechem achad. To be unified, shoulder to shoulder. To be unified, to serve God. So, if we put all this together, and I'm going to go to one more place and one more verse, and I will freely admit that most of this I thought about over Sukkot. Because I had time over Sukkot. What else do you do besides eat and drink and eat and shake? What concerned me was source number 13. Another one of the parashiyot we never get to learn, which is a good thing. Ha'azinu. Zechor yemot olam. Now what does that mean, zechor yemot olam? Remember the past. What does Rashi say? Masha asabari, in 14, Masha asabari shonim shehechisu lefanav. Remember how I treated those who did not behave. Continue reading the pasuk. Binu shno dor v'dor. Rashi writes, Binu shno dor v'dor, dor eno shehitzitfa leyen me okianus v'dor mabul sheshadfam. And I think a little later on, I may have cut it out, he also makes reference. Okay, we'll go to the next pasuk. Behan, okay, pasuk ched, in 13 pasuk ched. Remember the past, and he says, remember when people got me upset. Behan chil elyon goyim, Bahafridu b'nei Adam. Translate. Bahanchel elyon goyim. When God gave nachala, how would you translate that? When God gave inheritance, banchil elyon goyim. When God gave inheritance to the various nations, bahafridu b'nei Adam. When He divided them, what is this pasuk talking about? What does Rashi say? Bifridu b'nei Adam, Rashi writes, kishehifitz dor ha'palaga, ha'yibadyon v'haviram in olam, v'lo asaken el yatzav gvulot amim kimam v'lo avdam. That God could have destroyed them, that means that Rashi is saying, pshat in this pasuk, pshat in this pasuk, over here, again, back in 13, when God divided the people, divided them into nations, gave them inheritance, created boundaries, created borders, and what's the end of that pasuk? L'mispar b'nei Yisrael. He did this according to the numbers of the Jewish people. What in the world is he talking about? How is this the numbers of the Jewish people? So those of you who don't remember or don't know. So one thing. On Sukkot, how many korbanot do we end up bringing? 70. Why do we bring 70? We bring 70 because of the 70 nations. Do we need a Gemara to say that? Source 17, Amar Rabbi Eliezer or Elazar. Hinei shivim parim keneged mi keneged shivim umot. The 70 offerings which are brought are parallel to the 70 nations. Where do we get 70 nations from? By that chapter 11, which is interesting. That's chapter 11. By chapter 11, where the nations get spread out. If you count the number of descendants there, there are 70. And that's where the 70 nations come from, which means the 70 nations are a result of the inability of those nations of being unified, being one, and doing what it is that which they wanted to do. Where does it say, one second, it says that the 70 nations, where do we get the number 70? And again, that the Pasuk in Devarim, what does it say? When I divided them, l'mispar b'nei Yisrael, according to the number of the Jews. What number of the Jews? Rashi, l'mispar b'nei Yisrael, in source 14 again, b'shvil mispar b'nei Yisrael, sh'atidim latzei mi b'nei Shem, l'mispar shiv'im nefesh, shel b'nei Yisrael, sh'yordu l'mitzrayim. Hitziv gulot amim shivim lashon. So Rashi over here, and again, Rashi is telling you pshat in this pasuk, because these are what the words say. When I divided the nations, gave them their place, it is parallel to the Jewish people, it's parallel to the children of Yaakov, and that's very interesting. Because Yaakov now becomes the replacement for this 70 who didn't do that which is that they were supposed to do. Did that make any sense right now?
No.
Say it again. I'll say it again. I'll say it again. I'll try to say it again. The number of people who are then divided to become the 70 nations, we're told why the number 70? Because that's the number of Yaakov's descendants. Which right away you can say, ma? But I could say the other way around. Yaakov's descendants should be parallel to them, but it's not what it says. So I want to try to put this together and to offer an interpretation. And all of this, I think, is standing right in front of us. It's just a question of putting the pieces together. Yaakov has a vision. And by the way, it's interesting that Yaakov's vision is the first time he goes into Galut. Right? The first time he goes into Galut, because Yaakov's born in Eretz Yisrael. The first time he goes into Galut, he has this vision. When he comes back, he's going to go into Galut a second time. When he goes a second time, how many descendants go with him? 70. That's where the 70 is from. So you get to this point of, you know, for Ratzta, you're going to spread out and so on. But it's interesting, this vision is a pre-Galut vision. But in the midst of the pre-Galut vision, we have absolutely the most Eretz Yisrael vision imaginable. And what's that? The very core of the Kedusha, the very core of the holiness of Eretz Yisrael. And what's that? That's the Beit HaMikdash. So over here, what we have is, you're leaving, but there is this thing of holiness, and Yaakov can only leave, but by the way, maybe he can only leave when you also have a lighthouse, a place that you know where to turn to, a direction that you have to pray. And maybe that's the only thing which is going to keep us together as a people, when we know that there is this place of Kedusha that we need to be able to focus on. But what was missing in this generation that built this beautiful tower, which is, and I'll now say it again, which is paralleled to Yaakov's sulam, what was missing is that there's no mention of God. It's unity without religiosity. It's unity without acknowledgement of the divinity. It's unity to make a monument for ourselves. And what's jumping out of you over there is, it's let us build edifices. Is that the word? Is edify? Edify? How do you feel when you build an edifice? You feel edified, no? So let us build these big towers. Let us make accomplishments. Let us build things where we make this great city. And we're going to use all our resources together for us, for our glory. But there's one thing which is missing in that. And God comes and takes a look. Hey, you know, he whistles, yo, guys, you forget something? Over here, you know, look. And they're not there. On the other hand, what Yaakov's vision is right away, it's the angels going up, the angels going, and he looks at it, and he sees what this is really supposed to be. What is it supposed to be? It's supposed to be a Beit Elohim. What kinds of things do we build which really are supposed to unify people together? That's the going up and the going down, which means Yaakov understands this. The nations of the world, at least at that point, don't understand this. This is part of the Jewish vision, as much as we don't like to imagine it. Our vision is not just a vision which involves ourselves. It's also a vision where we bring korbanot for those who don't understand it yet. We bring korbanot for others. We need to spread out our understanding of God all over. And again, what are the, now go back to those psukim that I brought from the Navi. And the day will actually come where we're going to go back to the same point. We'll all speak one language, but we'll all speak one language and then be able to serve God. We're all going to speak one language, and then we're going to, then beti beit filatia l'kol amim. Which means the Jewish view of the end of days is not a Jewish view that we sort of corset all the non-Jews and they're not significant over here. This, and that's why I wanted, I'm going to say it again. When I read through Parshat Noach, the covenant that God makes with Noach is non-belligerency. It's okay, behave and I won't destroy you. That's all that there is. The love is missing. There's nothing more over there. The more can't come until there's a love story which takes place between man and between God, between when we see the angels going up and going down. And you can't see that. Avram develops this love. Avram develops this fascination with God and this love of God, this passion to God, and we find that God reciprocates. That's missing in this previous parsha. This parsha is going to end, and God is going to say, unity without any kind of divine power to it, without any kind of searching for God, without any kind of religious message to it, is a unity which is going to end up being very deconstructive. It's going to be a unity which can end up really not caring about people. It's a unity where you don't see the image of God within people. It's a unity which, at the end, needs to be broken up. But that's not saying that unity isn't good and speaking one language is good. And that's why, at the end of days, we will speak one language, we will serve God together. This Beit HaMikdash, Yad Vashem, and that's why I think it's very interesting, this Beit HaMikdash, we Beit Tefillah L'Kol HaAmin. But what we have over here is this Yaakov sees, maybe even, again, just to go a little crazy, maybe Yaakov sees exactly what they're trying to do, but he just realizes, but needs a different sign on it. It needs a different, you mentioned before the Zugots, it could be the exact same thing, that Yaakov sees this because they were around at the time. People did build these big towers. In the whole ancient Near East, people were building these big towers. They may have tried to build one, and Yaakov may try, envision one. But Yaakov understands the nature of it. The nature of building the towers in order to serve God. And therefore, as the vision ends, Yaakov is going to go into exile, and I'm going to say it again, he's going to go into exile again, and the 70 is going to be parallel to the 70, and we're going to bring offerings in for the 70. All that, as I said, all that is very, very simple, but it's at the end of days, at the end of time, we need to get back whereby God can come back and take a look and say, they speak one language, they're completely unified, and this is what they're doing. Not with a big question mark at the end, but with an exclamation point, this is what they're doing. They finally realize they need to bring God into the building, and that's what Yaakov sees right away. Kimza Beit Elokim. That's what Yaakov saw, but that's what they missed. And therefore what I'm suggesting is the only way to understand the tower is by reading it parallel together with the Sulam Yaakov. Shabbat Shalom.